All right, should be good to go.
All right, thanks so much.
Sure, no problem. If you need me, I'm in my office.
Okay, thanks. I'm Deb Baum. Today is July 23rd, 2013, and I am interviewing Susan Hartman, whose birth date is?
May 3rd, 1940.
Welcome, Susan. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
Could you describe the positions you held or the roles you played at Ohio State and in what units and over what time period?
Mm-hmm. I was director of the Center for Women's Studies from 1986 to 1992. I have been a professor of history from 1986 to 2011. I was professor of women's studies from 1986 until about 2000. I can't remember the exact date. And I was faculty athletic representative from 1995 to 2003.
Okay, and could you talk about your family background and experiences that shaped you prior to coming to Ohio State?
I grew up in St. Louis. Both my brother and I were first-generation college students. We both went to Washington University. It was expected that we would go to college. My parents weren't intellectuals, but they were avid readers, and they expected us to go to college, and so we did.
There was something about that generation of parents that didn't go to college, but just expected their kids to, wasn't there? It seems
it was that period, that post-World War II period of that tremendous expansion of higher education.
Yeah.
That really made it at least a middle class phenomenon.
People can envision the reality of it for their kids,
mm-hmm,
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. And could you talk a little bit about how generally you identify yourself and both how you see yourself and others see you in terms of the different kinds of identities, gender, race, religion, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. I think basically I'm just a white woman. I see myself very much as a teacher, secondly as a writer. Sports person.
Hmm. What was your, I know you're a tennis player.
Tennis.
Is that your main sport?
Mm-hmm. I ran for about 30 years and then I ran out of cartilage and had to give that up.
Yeah, that just didn't happen.
Yep.
Do you still do tennis?
I do.
Wow.
That's why I'm tired.
What
I played this morning.
What a great
sport that is,
though. Yeah. How has being a female shaped your life?
It gave me low expectations. I would say it gave me low expectations. I don't feel that I've had a lot of I've experienced a lot of discrimination as a woman. I think that was primarily a matter of timing of when I became an adult and when I started and pursued my career. But being a woman, it made me feel all the more grateful for what I was able to do. Again, I think because of low expectations.
Was it? It gave you low expectations for yourself, or gave you felt others had low expectations?
No, it gave me low expectations.
Yeah.
I never expected to go to graduate school or get a PhD or be a professor.
So then, how did you wind up making the decisions to do those?
It was largely circumstance. I did always like school, and I graduated. I went to Washington University. I within the space of 3 months, I turned 21, got my degree, and got married. And I had known for about the last couple of years that I thought I was going to get married when I graduated. And I looked for a major that would give me something to fall back on. Those were the words that we used.
That was the thing to do at the time.
So I got my teaching certification. I got married. My husband was in law school at the University of Missouri in Columbia. I got a job teaching high school. And he was in law school, but he was also working part-time. He was working at the university part-time, so we weren't totally dependent on my salary. I decided I still like school. I thought, oh, I'll get a master's degree in history. And so I took one course each semester in the evening after I finished teaching. And then my husband saw an advertisement for NDEA fellowships, National Defense Education Act fellowships. They funded mostly science programs. They came right after Sputnik. And they funded mostly science programs, but they also funded people working in modern U.S. history. And so he said, you know, why don't you apply for one of these? And I went to the office. And my first question was, do you ever give these to women? And they say, yes, we do. In fact, we have a couple of women in the program. And I applied. And I like to joke, the rest was history. Mm-hmm. They were three years of support. So it was beyond the master's. So All of a sudden, I had the opportunity to get a PhD, and I did. So.
Well, how interesting. Had modern U.S. history been your area of interest before that?
I liked everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, history was. I really loved history. I liked art history, but I thought that wasn't very practical as something to fall back on. Mm-hmm. So yes, I had always loved history.
You know, people talk about having these grand plans for their lives, but I have to believe most people things just happen like that.
Well, I was of that generation where women didn't. Yeah. We expected to get married and have children and, you know, maybe work if we had to or for extras.
That's true. Well, that is interesting.
A very, you know, circumstantial. If that program hadn't been available, if my husband hadn't seen the flyer, I didn't see it. I don't know what my alternative life would have been.
Yeah. And you got your PhD at Missouri?
I did.
Yeah. Wow.
Got it fast because he was graduating from law school and was moving on. We both moved to St. Louis. I continued to follow him. Mm-hmm. I got a job at the University of Missouri, St. Louis campus, which was a very new campus. Mm-hmm. I got a job teaching evening classes. Mm-hmm. That's what they offered me.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I noticed what the men who were teaching the same number of courses were getting, I went to my department chair and asked if I could get a raise. And he said, I actually tried to get you a raise, but the president pointed out that you're married. We don't know how long you're going to be here. Your husband could leave any time. And so you weren't, he didn't say these words, but it wasn't worth the investment in someone who. And I said, okay, well, thanks. I do appreciate your asking.
How many years were you there then?
I was there for 20 years.
Oh, you taught at that particular campus until you came here to Ohio State?
I did.
Did things change over time at that campus?
They did. They changed a lot. I mean, for one thing, the campus grew. And, I published my book. Got mostly treated equivalently with the men. Not exactly. I mean, that was a time where I experienced some what I consider to be sex discrimination. Mm-hmm. I thought that men were getting promoted to full rank, to full professor, before I was, and I thought that our resumes were really equivalent. But But yeah, it became a place, I liked it a lot. I felt very happy there, liked the students, liked everything.
Mm-hmm. And you came here in 1995?
86.
86, that's yes. Right, 86.
Yes, I was at University of Missouri St. Louis from 66 to 86, and then I came here. And that, too, was kind of coincidental. Two things happened. I was sitting next to another historian coming back from a meeting, and he wasn't at my school. And I don't know what the conversation was, but he made the comment that now was the time in my life, if I was ever going to move, that I would need to do it. I was 46 years old then, I guess, 45. Because at some point, you know, you're kind of dead meat, you're too old to move. So that was kind of in my head. And then Lila Roop, who I knew through the historical profession because we worked on some of the same topics, asked me to, if I would apply for a position here. And it was director of women's studies and then with a professorship in the history department. And I did, and I got it. It wasn't easy to move. I was pretty happy there. My parents lived in St. Louis, and they were, you know, they were getting older. But I was by that time divorced, not entangled with anybody, so I could move very, you know, easily in terms of personal relationships.
So you came here in 86 as head of, director of the Women's Day. It wasn't a department yet.
No, it was a center.
Center.
It was a center.
And how was it in that position?
It was fun. It was stressful. I really worked hard. I spent so many hours. But I had the opportunity, and the people around me, we had the opportunity to really build something. We did a lot of hiring. We redid the curriculum. We created a journal for the National Women's Studies Association. They had never had a scholarly journal. We did that here. And we got a master's degree in women's studies through. So it was just very rewarding. It was stressful. There was a lot of politics, especially among the students and the graduate students especially, who saw women's studies more politically and less scholarly than I did and other faculty.
And you probably laid the groundwork for the center becoming a department. I would guess a lot of what you did. Did Sally come after you?
She did. She followed me right after.
And one of her charges was to move the center to a department.
Yes.
So laid a lot of the groundwork for that. How big was the program when you came, and how big was it when you left?
I don't know. I know we were teaching 4,000 students a year when I left. I don't know how many we were teaching when I came. There were only 4 faculty when I came. And by the time I left, I don't know, there were probably 8 or 10. I don't know. Hiring was a challenge because we could not give anybody tenure. So those first years, I was running around all over campus talking to men who headed schools and departments, trying to get them to agree to a joint appointment for a new hire who would be half in women's studies and half in something else. And it was challenging, but it was also rewarding. There were some who were just I would say had no interest whatsoever. The social sciences were pretty much like that. And so I went around them, and we hired a sociologist through the Ag School, their Ag Economics and Rural Sociology, Kathy Rakowski.
Yeah.
We went to social work to get another sociologist. Mm-hmm. We got someone who did science in a way with a joint appointment with a nursing school. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like that puzzle, you know, trying to figure out who you could work with and who you couldn't.
Yeah.
Black Studies was always very very cooperative, and I really relied on them because we made a really, really determined effort to get women of color. Mm-hmm. And at that time it was African American women. Mm-hmm. Faculty members. Mm-hmm. And they were just wonderful. Manning Marable was there for a while. And then Ted, I can't think of his last name.
Oh, no, the jazz guy.
Yes.
I can't remember his last name either.
No. Ted. Mac something.
Oh, how can we both forget his name anyway?
We're old.
Ted the jazz guy.
Right. Daniels. Ted McDaniels.
Is it Ted McDaniels? I can't remember now. Isn't that funny? You just don't interact with somebody for a while, you just can't remember. Oh, wow.
And I guess one more thing I should maybe say about in the context of building the department is G. Michael Riley. Mm-hmm. He was dean of the College of Humanities, and he was just enormously supportive of what we were doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just can't imagine anybody being more supportive. Mm-hmm. So that was really a foundation on which to build women's studies.
Yeah, supportive leadership makes a huge, huge difference.
Yeah.
Did you participate in the meetings, the administrative meetings at the College of Humanities with the department chairs as a center director?
Executive committee, absolutely. Yeah, we were treated just like everybody else.
So Riley probably made that happen too.
Yes, he did. And that was really good because it really did connect you and it connected me with people that, you know, we did make joint appointments with some of those departments, primarily history and English. Maybe somebody else, can't think right now. But
So what was the climate like in the Center for Women's Studies? I guess both within, but also in terms of how the rest of the university interacted. You know, for the individuals in the center.
I think women's studies had quite a bit of respect. I don't think, you know, everybody in the university thought it was legitimate in terms of, you know, a scholarly enterprise. But I think that it was respected, and partly that was because our faculty were respected in their own departments. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, I think it was good to start out that way, because our faculty had greater visibility because they were all over the place, and other people could see, you know, the work that they were doing, the quality of their work. That doesn't mean that we didn't struggle. I mean, when we went after the master's degree, you know, that was a lot of work and a lot of pushing, and I think that probably the same thing with the PhD. I wasn't as involved, and I wasn't heading the department then, but I think the environment was just pretty good here. Mm-hmm. We didn't take up a lot of resources.
Oh. They always like you, you know, when you don't do that.
So, and it might be that we just weren't big enough for anybody to, you know, care about resisting what we were doing.
Now, you also were in the history department during that
same
time.
Yes, I was.
So
yes.
How was it?
Because there still aren't a majority
of women in history.
No, oh heavens, no. It's probably about a third, maybe a little over a third. When I came, there wasn't another full professor, full professor.
You were the first.
Well, I think they had one several years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, before I came, but there wasn't one, and there hadn't been any. And there weren't many women, period. It was pretty male. Lila Roop was promoted a couple of years after I got there, mm-hmm. so that was great with mm-hmm. one more person. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, we went in through a period of hiring people at the senior level, mm-hmm. and we got more women at full rank. Mm-hmm. What happened to make the history department, I think, much better was Warren Bantine. Mm-hmm. When he became chair, he really made an effort. He designed searches and search committees to make sure that women and African Americans, we were still at that point really kind of, you know, narrowly focused on African American mm-hmm. in terms of diversity. I mm-hmm. say that with a little embarrassment, but that's how it was. And when he was chair, we hired a bevy of young assistant professors, women. Mm-hmm. So that really changed the department a lot. Mm-hmm. It's still not. I don't think we reflect the percentage of women in the profession, and we've lost a lot of faculty generally to retirement. I think there's only one woman at full rank now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, several of us retired.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, but we also just promoted a bunch. Judy mm-hmm. Wu was just promoted. Mm-hmm. Alice Conklin was just promoted. Maybe somebody else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it'll get better again.
Yeah. So as the only full professor for at least a short period of time, what was that like? Because the numbers of women graduate students, I'm assuming, was starting to increase a little bit.
It was starting to increase some, mm-hmm. but not. I mean, I don't have mm-hmm. the numbers. We do have them somewhere, but mm-hmm. I don't know. I think perhaps I was so busy with women's studies that I didn't.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I do believe, though, that I did attend all the meetings and do all of that because I really wanted to be. And history was always my first love mm-hmm. anyway. I did want to be rooted in that department, but my appointments, there was only 20%.
Oh, okay.
And that was understood to be fulfilled by teaching one course.
One course a year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for 6 years, that's all the teaching I did.
One a year. When you stopped being a professor in women's studies in 2000, mm-hmm. why did that happen?
I wanted to be able to devote myself full time to history for mm-hmm. I knew I had about 10 more years mm-hmm. that I would be teaching, and then I just wanted to do that full time.
Mm-hmm.
And women's studies was going in directions that didn't appeal so much to me. I mean, I think they're fine, and I have no, I don't want to be critical of them, but they were just not my cup of tea. Theoretical, a lot of attention on representation and popular culture, and I think that's fine, but that's not, mm-hmm. that's not what I'm interested in, mm-hmm. so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead.
Maybe we ought to erase that.
Yeah, I think you can do that.
Okay. We don't have to do it now. But.
Could you talk a little bit about the 8 years you spent working on the athletic department issues?
Well, that was really interesting. I think it wasn't quite as out of control as it is now. I'm kind of aghast at how it is now, but... I enjoyed the contacts that I had with faculty from other universities who were doing essentially the same thing that I was doing.
And were you the faculty rep to the Big Ten? I can't remember what you said.
Yeah, it's to the Big Ten and the NCAA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that involved four or five Big Ten meetings a year. Mm-hmm. And then the NCAA, we had just one meeting a year, but the faculty reps also had a separate meeting, and then I was on a couple of committees that really involved me in much more in the NCAA. Mm-hmm. on campus, my main responsibilities had to do with the academic progress of students and violations of NCAA rules.
Any kinds of rules?
NCAA.
Any NCAA.
Most of the violations were in the area of coaches doing things that they weren't supposed to, making a phone call on the wrong day. Mm-hmm. They were in the area of coaches doing something like that, or what we called, it was getting illegal benefits, students getting things that they shouldn't be getting from somebody. And I overlapped pretty much with Andy Geiger. And he was very good about compliance with NCAA rules. It was called an executive compliance committee, and we met every week. And the associate athletic director, someone from financial aid, someone from the registrar's office, academic affairs, and stuff would come up like, I saw X driving a Humvee. Somebody find out where, it was, it made me wonder if they were still doing that when we had the problem a couple of years ago, because there was a lot of, scrutiny on the high profile athletes. What impressed me about, that I hadn't really, realized before I took that job was the scope of athletics, and how many we had like 36 teams. We had as many women's teams as men's. We had to, and that kind of opportunity for all those athletes. It was close to 1,000, maybe more like 800 or 900 athletes. The opportunities that a school like Ohio State was able to provide for. Mm-hmm. Not the star basketball or football players, but all of these athletes who played field hockey or fenced or played lacrosse. And they were great, they were great kids. It was fun to get to know some of them.
While you were at Ohio State, did you have concerns in your unit or at the university in general about equity issues?
Yeah, all the time.
Could you talk a little bit about and what made you aware of it?
I think what frustrated me most was that everybody would pay lip service to equity and not go about it as in the most obvious, simplest ways to do it. It always seemed to struggle. It seemed to me the university put a lot of money in committees and programs and administrators. And where they should have put the money was, on the backs of people who were willing to get things done. That is, department chairs, units that had good records and that, that would hire, and then take money away from from units that didn't. It's not hard to figure out how to do it. I didn't have any training when I came here, but I think, and I had a lot of people helping me, but I think that we did a great job in finding minority candidates and getting them. But that wasn't a characteristic across the board. And other units, or people would, express interest, cooperation, commitment, but when the chips were down, they made it hard. Mm-hmm. I heard of Valerie Lee, and maybe we can take her name out of this, you know, retract her name or whatever, but I found her teaching over at Denison, and I arranged for her to teach a summer course at Ohio State to see if we liked her and she liked us. She did, and so I, you know, got a position, got the English department interested. We had to push some, and finally they agreed, but they wouldn't give her full rank. She was at full rank at Denison. They made her come here as an associate professor. And, you know, that kind of thing. And then they realized how great she was. She, you know, she became their department chair, and, you know, she's everything. But that's just kind of a small example of the drag on, you probably experienced the drag on trying to do something. And we have all these officers. I just read in the paper, you know, the medical school now has a diversity officer. You need a diversity officer. You need somebody going around to medical schools and finding people who you want to get here. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
I know we made that argument for years, is reward the units that are doing it. And that's where the leadership, I guess, is so important.
Well, and
I mean, you did it in your unit because you were committed and you did it.
Right. Yeah. And it wasn't just me. But,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
But,
yeah.
And it's not, it doesn't take a genius to know how to do it. It's like, I mean.
Why do you suppose it seems like an easy solution.
I don't know.
Think of all the person hours we spend on these things.
Yeah.
That we wouldn't if people would just.
So I think the university has done a lot better. That's obvious if you look at numbers. But I think it's not easy, and it takes a lot of energy out of the people who want to see it happen. Mm-hmm. It takes too much energy out of them. Mm-hmm. Energy they should be able to be, you know, doing something else with. Mm-hmm.
And I think the Women's Place latest report, some of the data actually is falling back.
Is it?
The number of women department chairs is
backsliding. Right? Is that right?
But you know, the numbers of women full professors is gradually increasing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you here when we celebrated having 100 women full professors? I can't remember.
I don't remember
86.
It.
86. That had to have happened because I remember, I didn't come until 85.
Hmm.
I think that was early 90s.
Yeah. Hmm.
The old CAEW used to have the celebration every year for women who had been promoted to anything, given tenure or promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the year, finally, we hit the 100 mark. Now, we have quite a few more now.
Out of, like, what? 1,500.
It wasn't very many.
Yeah, it wasn't
very many. Maybe 3,000. I think there were 3,000 or 4,000.
Yeah.
But out of full professors, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, there are lots of the data is greatly improved, but it does. It seems like it was just a huge struggle to do anything.
And to get, you know, to get stuff like maternity leave and stopping the tenure clock. I was on a committee that I think Debbie Merritt chaired that committee. Gosh, I mean, we had to go to a million meetings, you know, and spend a year and a half. And, you know, and we got it, and it was great. But that ought to be something that you can do, you know.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Was there any pressure from above when you were the center director to do these things?
What do you mean?
To do the hiring you did, or is that
to
just
do the
was
diversity?
Your value?
No,
you know,
it's the value of women's
value.
Studies.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had been involved in women's studies before I came here. I mean, I wouldn't have had the job, but you know, those of us who were involved in feminism, for me, it was in the early 70s. That's where I learned most about race and discrimination and everything. And, you know, once you learn those things, you just take them with you.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take those commitments with you.
Well, having never been a chair or a dean, it always seemed to me that if the chair or dean, if they were committed, things happened, and if they weren't, they didn't happen, because nobody up above made them.
Right. No.
In spite of what you were saying earlier, all their talk, they just didn't.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just like Warren Van Tine.
Could you talk about the most powerful experience you had at Ohio State?
Oh my gosh, I should have read those questions over.
There might be many powerful experiences. Mm.
No, I can't single out anything, really. I should have been thinking about it. My retirement was pretty awesome.
Yeah, you had to talk a little, if you don't mind, about your retirement. And
well,
I know the word from the students in the history department, because as you know, I was a grad student in history, was that they really wanted to finish their PhD, they needed to get Susan Hartman as their, as their advisor, because they would finish their...
I feel very proud of that. Yeah. I do. Well, about, I don't know, maybe 20 of my former students, and they were not all students who I was their primary advisor. Mm-hmm. Some of them were Lila's. Lila was the major advisor. But I think about 20 of them came back and did a conference.
Mm-hmm.
Did you?
Yeah, I knew about it. Oh, yeah, I wasn't able to go, but I knew about it.
And Brigitte Soland, my colleague, she was kind of the point person in the department, and she really put everything together. But the students organized... they organized a mini conference, and they presented their work, and it was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was wonderful that, you know, that so many of them came back. Mm-hmm. And then there was a reception in the history department afterwards, and then there was a dinner, and it was just quite wonderful.
Well, it's a powerful tribute.
It was powerful. Yeah. Yeah, they came from California and New York, and I don't know how far south, maybe Tennessee. Yeah. But that was powerful.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what else was powerful.
Well, I think it illustrates how you really felt you were a teacher first and then a writer, if you have. Because you obviously are a great scholar, too, but the fact that the students were so devoted. That,
well, they were great. Yeah. They were wonderful. And, you know, I will take credit, along with Lila, for building a really strong women's history program.
Mm-hmm.
It's fallen off now, but we both, the two of us, attracted really good students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've gone off and done really wonderful things.
Did a woman named Carol Rose remain in women's history anyplace? I was an undergrad in 72, and she taught the very first women's history course that Ohio State ever. She wasn't a tenured faculty. She was an instructor.
Warren always took credit.
She was an instructor. Well, it's possible it was in his name, because she wasn't a tenured professor. She was an instructor.
Yeah, I don't know her.
I think she went off to law school. She didn't stay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just always wondered whatever happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I was proud to have taken the very first women's history course that was ever offered.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
I taught the first women's history course in two places, at Boston University and at University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Yeah.
Those were both probably right around, I think, 71 in Boston, at Boston at BU, and then maybe 72 in UNSL.
I don't know how it was for the faculty who taught the first one, but for students who could take that class, it was really powerful to be able to take such a class. And you think, everybody just takes it for granted. But that's good. We want them to be able to do that.
That's right.
Did you personally work to affect institutional change around equity issues? You've talked a lot about the hiring, which is certainly a powerful way to affect issues.
The other thing that I got involved in was the round of curriculum revision that took place in the early 90s. Could have been the late 80s, I don't remember, but it was a major revision of the general education requirements. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty far along when a couple of us in women's studies realized that there wasn't any diversity. And we worked with some other, with department chairs from other units, and we got the diversity requirement through. Mary Margaret was really worked hard on that. She was assistant director in women's studies for a long time. Mary Margaret Fano, who ought to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to try to interview her somehow.
Yeah. But we did that, you know. I mean, these revisions were going along, an entirely new set of general education requirements, and we got a social diversity requirement put in there. Mm-hmm. So that's probably what I see as mm-hmm. the biggest thing. I worked on that committee for the stopping the tenure clock for childbirth adoption. Mm-hmm.
Was that curriculum committee, was that the one chaired by Jerry Reagan from education?
Was that the one? I think
it was
so.
The massive revision.
Yeah, I do believe now that you remember, that you say that, yeah. Yeah, it was a massive revision.
And I'm thinking the social diversity, a lot of, this is just my impression,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of white men wound up taking the women's studies class to fill that.
We
as
did
they would
have
say,
a lot of,
so they
yeah,
could meet
right.
women, but then they really were impacted by
right.
the class.
Right.
So.
Well, and that's why our number, you know, I said that we were teaching probably 4,000 students, and that's why, because of that requirement. We did get a lot of men, and a lot of them, they often would say that their girlfriends or their mothers made them take it. But no, that had a direct impact on women's studies. We weren't, you know, cynically promoting it for that reason, but...
Well, I think it had a direct impact on a lot of men, too.
Right,
it was
right,
really positive.
Right.
So,
yeah. And I think that has survived all the revisions since then.
Yeah. It's interesting how you just one thing like that can really have a serious impact.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you talk about allies? You talked about Warren Bantine as an ally, Mike
mm-hmm.
Riley as
mm-hmm.
an ally. Were there other allies who really supported change around equity issues
that I know of? Around equity issues.
And it also... obstructionist people were obstructed.
Well, that was just about everybody. Or not so much obstructionists as just passive, you know, they were kind of sitting passively in your way and you couldn't, you know, move them. My memory is just so, obviously the leadership in Black studies would, mm-hmm. and most women on campus were sympathetic. There were people like Debbie Merritt. I thought she was really mm-hmm. effective in the stuff that she did. I don't know. My memory is not very...
Of course, the ones who would have impacted you most, I assume, would be in humanities. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Either at the point, of course, you just retired 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think remains undone relative to progress for mm-hmm. women and other diverse groups at the university?
Hmm. Well, I mean, I think we have to do better numbers across the board, students, mm-hmm. faculty. I'm not close to how people are feeling about climate, but you know, things that you hear about and read suggest that those are issues that we need to work on. I'm appalled at what is happening in terms of female coaches in athletics.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little more about that?
Well, I don't have numbers, but look across at basketball games, and we've had a male, we have our second male coach, and their assistants are mostly men, and you know, I think that just shouldn't be. And other coaches I've noticed, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to come up with names right now, that men have replaced women as coaches of women's, you know, of women's teams. So I think that's an area that I don't have numbers, but my impression is that we have lost ground in terms of female coaches. You say we have in terms of department chairs.
Certainly in terms of vice presidents we have. Which is, all of those are really functions of leadership values, I think.
Exactly. And we have way too many vice presidents, of course, I think. I think the curriculum is pretty good. I think that certainly women's studies is thriving, seems to be thriving, as far as I can tell. And that gender is being taught everywhere, maybe not in the hard sciences, but it's really being taught around campus.
What changes did you see in women's students over the, over here about
20 years?
About 20 years. What changes did you see?
I can think of changes in students in general. I'm not sure that I could. I'm not sure that I could say that they were specific to women. I mean, we all know that our students are so much better prepared. They're better readers. They're better writers. But I don't have a sense of female students changing. I'm sure they have, but I don't know how they have. I didn't know a lot of undergraduates. My first 6 years here, I taught a graduate course in the history department, and that was it. That's all the teaching I did, because I was administering. So I didn't have undergraduates for a long time. Do you think they've changed? That women have changed?
I think, based on, and I did have a lot of undergraduates. I think that I would say overall, I think the women, I was in the College of Business, I think women became more confident and more assertive over that time.
I think you would see that in business. And you probably have a lot more than you used to, didn't you, or not?
You know, it's pretty much stuck at about, at least at the point I retired, about 40% of undergrads.
And it was that in 1990?
I think it was pretty much.
Really?
It's pretty much been 35 to 40.
Is that right?
It hasn't changed.
Didn't know that.
I think the numbers in the MBA changed some, although it's still not a huge amount. But it could be a function, again, of the students overall, just better qualified students. But it got to the point in business that there were lots of clubs. Probably humanities had a lot of clubs. There were just lots of clubs. And it got to the point almost all of the presidents were women. So then the debate became, well, what are we doing wrong for these guys? Well, they were still 60% of students.
You know, that actually reminds me of something that I think is, and I don't know if this is just history, but it is, I think it is a severe problem, and that is that women do all the service. You know, they don't, obviously they don't do all of it, but there's an extreme difference overall in terms of who serves on committees, who holds positions in the department, and I think it retards our female associate professors from moving up.
I'm always appalled when I hear that somebody's an associate and just was named to some major administrative position.
Right.
I think, why don't do this?
Right.
When I was at the women's place, women would come and tell me, I say, do not do this.
Yeah.
You have to be promoted
before. We have one who just served as graduate studies chair. We have 100 graduate students.
Yeah.
Graduate studies chair for 3 or 4 years. And now, yet a different associate professor is going to be undergraduate studies chair. And the chair says, well, there's nobody, you know, who will do it. No, because you've got, you know, 10 or 15 men who really don't, you know, don't do the work. And if you make them do it, they'll screw it up.
Yeah.
You know, they won't do it. And students will get hurt. And so, I think that's a problem. And I'm not sure how you solve it.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think it is, too.
I think you could bear down. We've tried to bear down with Sal on determining raises, you know, evaluating people, making service, but it's still not, you know, we still haven't done enough to make it, make those men who don't do it really feel something, you know, accept the benefits of writing another book.
What topics should we have covered that we didn't? Anything you can think of that we ought to have for the history of women at Ohio State University?
History of women at Ohio State. I think we've talked about, you know, just about everything that I can think of. I'm sure I'll think of a million things. Tonight. If I think of anything important, maybe we can attach it.
Oh, yeah, I think we probably could. This isn't on the list of questions, but I mean, you were a powerful player at Ohio State. You were a powerful person, a powerful woman to have at Ohio State. I think when you came, I was still an assistant professor, and it was wonderful having you there. What do you hope your legacy will be viewed as from Ohio State?
Well, I think, I mean, my students aren't at Ohio State anymore, but, you know, obviously I think that's my biggest legacy. I do feel that, you know, I've done just about everything I can to promote diversity. That doesn't mean that, you know, I've done a lot more than other people, but I feel that that's one of the things that I've, an important thing, a very important thing that, that I've done here. I do think I came to women's studies at a critical time, and I'll take some credit. I won't take, you know, a lot of credit, but I'll take some credit for the fact that Sally was able to take that and then, you know, become a department and a PhD program. And I had Mary Margaret Fanneau was really central to everything that I did. She became assistant director, I think, the second year that I was there. And, you know, she was just wonderful. So I think those are. I don't know that I had a great impact on athletics. I think, you know, I think it was just too big to, you know, for one person to do that.
Did they replace you with a whole office now? Or is there still, you had a particular position that still
exists? John, what's his name? He's in psychology. I think his name begins with a B. I can't remember.
I know who you mean too, but I can't remember his last name.
Yeah.
Is he still does it?
Yeah. I think he's probably stayed on too long, but I believe that's a position that should really rotate. Yeah.
I'll ask this in the interview so that it can trigger your memory later, but do you have any memorabilia, photos, newspaper articles, files, reports, anything that the archives could copy to keep in the records here that you would be willing to share?
Well, I don't think I have anything systematic. you know, I left the women's studies stuff. I do have an office I have to clean out one of these days.
Well, even just things on your conference, do they have that here? The conference that honored you when you retired? I mean, that would be a great thing to have.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a very embarrassing slideshow.
Well, they ought to have that here.
A couple of my students were digging around at Washington University, and the thing that they found was I think they found two photographs of me as a dance, a court, you know, and one was the ROTC Queen, ROTC, and I think the other was Homecoming. But I think that was the most embarrassing part of the slideshow. I mean, there is a program, you know, the conference program.
Yeah.
Certainly I could
send that. Would be a good thing.
Send that over. That's very nice. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Mary Margaret as someone to interview. Who else that we haven't?
Well, is Sally on the list?
They're both in our document, and actually everybody in that document, that Pathfinder's documents, I would hope could be interviewed, although there are hundreds in there.
But
other than those two, can you think of any?
People around women's studies.
Not just anybody. I'm even thinking we should start interviewing people like Warren Van Tine. We need to have his interview. Okay, well, Susan, this has been wonderful. Yes, thank you so much.
Yeah.